This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
This morning I was remembering reading one of Thomas Mann's novels, Wooden Brooks, which I very much enjoyed. I saw a reference to it recently in a review of another book, and somebody's mentor had given him this novel in the 1930s in Germany, and it was representative of certain wonderful cultural and familial values. So he meant it as an instructive gift. But what I recall, actually almost nothing of the book except enjoying it. And there was one character who appeared just occasionally, an elderly Frau Weisbrot, who came to Christmas and other events in the family. And whenever she did, she would make sure to go to each of the children at least at various times. There were quite a few. And she would say to each one, "Be happy, you good child." And that was all she said in the whole book several times. And for some reason, that sank in. And today I was thinking that, in fact, that should be pretty much our message for our children. It'd be nice if that were our only message for our children. But it turns out that they might need a little help with that. Because inevitably, pretty soon, they will notice that happy isn't the only thing that shows up. And then they will be maybe a little confused to have received this very nice message. Be happy, you good child. And to have found it somewhat puzzling. Like, how does that exactly work? All of us have witnessed, even if we don't remember our own, we've witnessed tantrums of dissatisfaction on the part of other small humans. And it's amazing how intense it can be and how profound the misery is of this small being who is, at least at that point, not prepared to grapple intellectually with the encounter with dukkha, as Buddha called it. So there's really nothing much to do except scream, and so that's what they do. So given that as part of the background, teaching our children how to be happy is deceptively simple. Now, the best way, probably, I think, is somehow by example. If we assume that all children, just like all dogs, are good, and that if they sometimes don't act that way, well, then it's just a little confusion happening, that's all. It'll help a lot if we ourselves as parents, and I don't mean to be lecturing to parents since I'm not one myself, so my main credential for speaking this morning is having been a child. That's about all I can offer. And having grown up a Catholic child, the message, be happy, you're a good child, wasn't quite what I got. It was a little more, nuanced is a nice word for it. But if our adult models that we see seem to be understanding how it's possible to be happy in our human situation, this will go a long way to affecting the child without having to tell them a bunch of stuff that they're supposed to do or not do. Goodness knows there'll be plenty of that. So perhaps the main point in how we might model such a thing is in how we ourselves relate to dukkha or misery. And sooner or later we encounter really what Buddha meant by dukkha, which is not just mere dissatisfaction with something. As we've said before, Buddha was speaking of the profound imbalance at the root of the sentient beings' misunderstanding of reality, and the imbalance that causes, which is a little bit like having a bad hip joint or something, causing us constantly to kind of be out of kilter in the world, and as a result, generating many unhelpful currents for ourselves and others. And this is what is called samsara, the round of becoming. So how we relate to our own profound imbalance, as I say, will have a significant and spreading impact. And in Buddhism, the first thing that we're told is to expect that, and to understand that a lot of what we've already seen in our life as that has been unpleasant and difficult and so forth goes right back to Buddha's teaching about dukkha. So having heard that teaching, first of all, we're not so surprised when that comes along and maybe knocks us over for a while. We hope that this supplants the many meretricious message from our superficial culture, which tells us that a certain mechanical approach to happiness will work, a kind of mix of possessions and pursuits. And if you get that right, you will be happy. And usually, somewhere along the line, our own Trungpa Rinpoche called basic sanity will kind of clue us into the fact that there's something missing in that formula. There's some pieces missing, and in fact, it does not balance. So if that's not quite how to handle things, then what do we do? So Buddha suggested that we adopt a very, very intimate study of how it works. And by it, I mean principally this body-mind and the universe that it almost literally generates. So in order to do that, usually it helps to simplify our environment somewhat, reduce our physical activity and thereby our mental activity, and then watch what's happening and allow the study of what's happening, hopefully we would say the unbiased study of what's happening, to draw power from basic sanity. And over time, our warped view of the world shifts. Eventually, so much that the process of karma is completely interrupted. As you know, the process of karma is always based on wrong view. And even what we call good karma and bad karma, both are rooted in wrong view. And wrong view, as you also know, means I think I and you literally exist separately. That's one way to sum it up. And that certainty will be eroded by this kind of study that I'm talking about. Without your having to, I don't know, conceive of yourself with a little hard hat, a little light on it, a little hammer chipping away at things. That's not necessary, and in fact, that's just baggage which you won't need. Just this study that I'm talking about erodes wrong view in the face of the basically constant reinforcement of wrong view that comes from culture, among other things. So, last week, our guest lecturer, Jing Hao, gave us a nice talk from a slightly different point of view. And I recall that he mentioned Dogen's little précis of meditation practice that people quote a lot and sometimes relate to as impenetrably mysterious, although it isn't at all. This business about you should cultivate non-thinking. And so he says, as I know we've explained before, there's thinking and there's not thinking. But I'm talking about non-thinking or unthinking, he says. And although there's a certain tendency to make that as though it was some sort of weird technique that cool Zen people know and nobody else does, that's actually not it at all. He's actually talking about the framing for this kind of study that I've been speaking of, and the subtle point is that to allow the natural vitality of this body-mind to produce thoughts if it wants, not produce thoughts if it wants, without sticking your oar in there and trying to make the boat go in some particular way, is actually non-thinking. Because that's not what we usually do. Mostly, we're into thinking. Mostly. And then, sometimes, if you decide that somebody tells you that, well, thinking is like the evil, and you can get that impression from certain Buddhist texts, that what you're supposed to do is get rid of that. So then you try to get to non-thinking, or unthinking, or rather, not thinking. So, cut off all those thoughts. Make them all go away. And one way is you hit them all over the head with a blunt instrument, sometimes called a hwato, or hato in Japanese, which is a word or phrase from a Zen story that you use to beat your thoughts to death. And you can do that. And this was another, 11th, 12th century innovation. And in kind of synchronicity with that innovation, you have this other one that's called just sitting, where you're actually invited not to beat anything to death, but allow the natural dynamism of the body-mind to express itself in such a way that you can see that without constant re-energization, our mental activity slowly decreases until there is only a great silence that is this body mind. And in that great silence, there may even be thoughts arising, passing away, and they are irrelevant. So you don't have to kill your thoughts. And this relationship, you might say, to the processes of this body-mind is unthinking, or hishiryo. Sorry, fushiryo is, well, I forget, anyway. Shiryo, fushiryo, hishiryo. Hishiryo is non-thinking, right? Unthinking. What we don't usually do, which is let things alone. Right? Let them be as they are. Right? And use your body in a useful way. Right? You find some balance, some way to be settled. And let this process unfold. And then, miraculously, something like the Suzuki Roshi's assurance that in 5 or 10 minutes, your mind will be calm is true. He doesn't necessarily mean all your thoughts will go away in 5 or 10 minutes. He means you will understand the meaning of calm body mind after just a few minutes, once this heart is recognized. Okay? And I just want to say that last week I thought there might be some danger that people would understand the beat your thoughts to death approach as active and the other approach as passive. And I want to clarify that it is nothing of the kind. It is not passive. And that if our approach to sitting is passive, it will actually be unhealthy. Right? So that's why we recommend that the attention be engaged in the body-mind in a useful way. So there's a certain posture that's found to be very helpful for this, so that our sitting doesn't become passive. We don't recommend slumping. We don't recommend closing your eyes. We recommend breathing attentively through your nose, not through your mouth, unless you can't breathe through your nose, which sometimes happens. Keeping your head upright and coming to know and to notice how this body's geometry suggests balance, right? And to remain gently and, in fact, actively engaged in what's going on without interfering. This is not passive. So I just want to clarify, in case there are any misapprehensions, that it's not that one way is active and the other passive. And, in fact, at the heart of each of these stylistic approaches is the same Bodhi nature. So the fact that they differ stylistically is not so important. And it is important that we understand that and we not get confused about such things. Because even good old Dogen, our friend, can plausibly at times be accused of sounding kind of sectarian, railing against certain other, I don't know who they were, people and practices and so forth. He might be excused for being kind of cranky because they did kind of kick him out of Kyoto, which did not make things easier for him. Might have turned out better in the long run, but the established Buddhist powers that were, which meant basically the Tendai and Shingon schools, really made it hard for him to have his voice heard at all. So finally he left Kyoto, and maybe he had some bad days. And I don't remember him, at least it's not recorded, that he ever said, "I'm having a bad day, don't pay attention to me. I'm being cranky." He never says that, but one can get the impression that he had such bad days, just like the rest of us. Meanwhile, this marvelous teaching about how to relate to this mystery, body-mind, in a way that's actually helpful to ourselves and others, has survived down the centuries and is now in our care. So I want to thank you all for taking a piece out of your weekend and spending it practicing together. I find that very encouraging. And I notice if I'm by myself in the temple too much, I get a little gloomy because there aren't people to practice with. Fortunately, we have a dog who's always here, and that's great. Dogs are a marvelous antidepressant, you might say. So we have a very nice dog, very small. You can carry it around the house all day if you want. She actually likes that. So we had that, but it's also great to have the Sangha together and be doing stuff together. So come October, We're going to try to have a study period where we try to spend a little more time together for a few weeks, ending with our session, our retreat in December. And you're all invited to participate as much or as little as you like, as you can. And that'll be kind of nice. And I'm still not sure if we have like a detailed announcement about it, or maybe we won't ever. Maybe we'll just keep saying we're going to do this. And we have a kind of a date. It's at the end of October. I forget exactly. Maybe the last weekend of October, Saturday, we're going to start. And we'll just, I don't know what we can do. All of us have a lot of stuff to take care of in our lives, other people, dogs, and so forth. So I don't know if maybe we'll try to add a period of Zazen or something, and then we'll have a class and maybe a tea once a week, stuff like that. And then maybe one or two shorter retreats, like maybe just half a Saturday or a whole Saturday or something like that. And so all keep your eye out for such things and sign up if you can and if you want to. And don't look at it as an invitation to be tortured, because we're not into that. And if practice is torture, then there's something wrong. That's really not supposed to be the case. You can't really, as Buddha found, you can't really study the self that way. You can't study reality if you're being tortured. So we don't do that. You also can't study reality very well if you're like, loaded on margaritas or bloated with Thanksgiving turkey or various other things that make it difficult. So Buddha basically just says, avoid that stuff, right? Kind of stay in somewhere in the middle most of the time, and your basic sanity will, like a timid forest animal, come forward in a way that can be encouraged but not coerced. I mean, it's there, it's part of all of us, and the fact that you're just sitting here is ample demonstration. So you don't have to worry about that. But remember, like a timid forest animal, you can't make it do what you want. Right? It has its nature, and you can trust that. That's probably all I was going to say today. And I don't know if people want to ask questions or make a comment or speak about their own dog or dogs. That's also okay. Yes.
I was thinking on the bus the other day. It's bad enough that we think that we're here and you're over there, mm-hmm. and are separate. But it's actually worse than that to me. I'm sort of a completely different class of being from everybody else, if I'm mm-hmm. honest with myself. Right? So I'll attribute motivation to other people that I would never attribute to myself. Mm-hmm. and most of the people I know seem to be pretty much the same way. So I was thinking, well, maybe there's even a biological, it's clearly wrong, but maybe there's sort of an adaptive significance to it, and maybe it mm-hmm. helped when, the anatomically modern humans were confronting the Neanderthals in the Middle East or something.
Yeah, I think that must be right. And some would say there's such a thing as collective karma, although it's not clear to me how that's supposed to work. I don't think Shakyamuni Buddha talked about that. So I think this is a later invention that somebody came up with. There's collective karma, there might be species karma, there might be national karma, which has something to do with groups of sentient beings who all are, to some degree, moving in the same direction with similar motivations and so forth. And this creates a kind of, like a species-wide karma, which may partake of what you're talking about. And if so, then there will be a certain karmic pressure in certain directions, namely towards individual supremacy, right? For instance, we may come to the point where either I have to eat you or you have to eat me, and I'd rather that I eat you. This could be a part of our, deep programming as sentient beings with species karma. Now, it doesn't mean we have to do that, but there may be that tendency, okay? And so it's very good if we have deep trust in our basic sanity and can let that assert itself in circumstances where the easy way would be just go with whatever tendency happens to be present at the time. And if that means eat your neighbor, well, go ahead, eat your neighbor. Personally, I'd rather be dead than eat my neighbor. So if it comes to that, let's hope it doesn't come to that. But let's learn what it means to trust basic sanity when these biological or whatever they are, deep impulses emerge, so that there's something else in play. Okay, and I think that's quite possible. Jeff, did you have a question?
No, the comment? When you brought up the passive.
Yeah, active, passive. Yeah.
Yeah. I find that it's kind of an interesting, sometimes I trend passive, and particularly in Zazen, or Zazen, not just on the cushion, but all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when things become habit, you trend toward the passive. So, mm-hmm. I guess I wanted you to say maybe something a little bit more about the state of mind, both on the cushion and outside, mm-hmm. just as a reminder.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find that I think what I would tend to call what you're referring to as complacency.
Mm-hmm.
And our particular Dharma family has been accused at times that is our tremendous weakness, is that it's the more accustomed you get to the process of sitting, for instance, the closer you get to a place of complacency where everything's fine and I'm just kind of actually being sort of lazy and not even noticing it. In other words, when I sit, I'm actually kind of sinking into a kind of dream, mm-hmm. or dullness or something. And I don't even care. I don't even pay attention because I'm saying, well, everything's Buddha anyway. What the hell? And in fact, our family has that pitfall, as we've talked about. Now, the family that suggests beating your thoughts to death, they have their own pitfalls. And there were periods where the families were pointing fingers at each other and saying, yeah, yeah, pitfall, pitfall. And, well, it's okay. Maybe that was helpful up to a point. But indeed, what I find is that something, if I'm getting complacent, something will remind me. Something will cause me to notice that. And as long as I am, open to being reminded, it's not a problem. Because I will always be reminded by something. Something happening in the street, some sound, something happening in my body will be like a little bell going off saying, watch, don't just snooze on the cushion. This is not the same, really, as sometimes we're just tired and we're falling asleep, and that's not the same thing as complacent.
Mm-hmm.
Complacent is, I'm falling asleep and who the fuck cares? Mm-hmm. That's a little different, and that will drain the energy away from our practice. Okay. So that's...
it also depends, my psychological landscape can vary from the Sahara to Seattle, so it kind of, it rolls with that.
Yep.
Too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to understand that there's a basically sane traveler in all of those landscapes is helpful, which is why Dogen and others say, trust your Buddha nature. Why? Because the Buddhas and ancestors weren't selling you a bill of goods. Or if they were, it was meant to be helpful. Yes.
I like the metaphor about the timid forest animal.
Uh-huh.
And it seems like you don't want to be hunting the timid forest animal or trying to capture it. It's like the goose with the golden egg, it reminds me. It's like that kind of paradox where if you grasp it, you kill it.
Right. Yeah, that's been my experience. And as it happens, the forest animal is also timid, shy is maybe a better word, but is also, what's another word for it? If you see a timid forest animal, there's a, a lot of grandeur about them. Even a small critter, a possum bumbling along or something, had this sort of quiet grandeur about them because they are just exactly the way they are. So the animal is not some, the shy animal has a strength too, which is important to remember. It may seem, especially at times, that it's a delicate creature, but it's actually not really delicate. And the more we learn that, the more we trust that, and the more that affects our lives. Yes?
I was going to say, I remember this woman who used from Zen Center used to come occasionally to classes. I think that you would teach when I first started coming to Hartford Street, and every once in a while she'd raise her hand and say, could you repeat that? Because my mind wandered.
Oh, uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And at first I was like, that's funny. And then I thought, I just thought that was wonderful, because uh-huh. it was embracing the fact that, my mind wanders.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be honest about it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to, keep the effort to pull it back. But mm-hmm. I thought that was very freeing for some reason to admit to someone, could you say that again? Because my mind.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And it's good to remember that the mind wandering is part of its dynamism. It's not some fault. And that some ways of education actually stress. Follow the mind's own energy where it wants to go. And then that can be extremely good for people, for children, our good children. Yes?
I enjoyed the part of the talk where you mentioned the beating down of thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me, the only thing you can beat thoughts down with are always thoughts. So if you think you've achieved something that way, I don't know what it could be.
Well, yeah.
But I remember, Rabbi Anderson, there's this week-long session at the Green Gulch, so there's these very devoted advanced practitioners, and mm-hmm. I'm sort of sitting on the floor looking up at the time. But he gave a talk where he said, it's okay to think of the Zendo. Mm-hmm. Most of you, for example, most of you are thinking in the Zendo. For example, most of you think that you're in this room.
Right.
And this was very upsetting to me, but he actually had to retract it a few days later, saying, it's okay, if you don't think you should think of the Zendo, don't think of the Zendo. There seems to be a lot of confusion around.
Yeah. Most of us think we're in this room. Well, that's true. It's very true. And Buddha's advice is not that you have to kill that thought, but examine that thought and see what it's based on. What does being in a room actually mean in this body-mind? And the closer you examine it, the closer you analyze it, the more you will see it's actually not based on anything that doesn't move in response to everything else. This is the basis of, quote, emptiness, unquote. Okay? That's what is at its heart. It's nothing more complicated than that. So, again, this is just another example of this intimate study of our situation and how that can help us to understand what happy might mean for sentient beings in a way that's liberative rather than constraining. Again, thank you for coming to practice this morning. And as your reward, we will now give you tea and cookies. Please take care.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I long to see them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.